You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. For people working on climate change, there is this grim fact that hovers behind every conversation. The climate system has a tremendous amount of inertia, like a battleship or a runaway train. Even in the best of all political worlds, even if the world's nations hopped to attention, switched off their coal plants, decommissioned their fleets of internal combustion cars, and defossilized the world's energy economy overnight, the planet would keep getting hotter for a long time. How much time is something scientists model and debate at great length, but it is a matter of decades, not of months. Now, that fact has very smart people all over the world trying to figure out how to save the things we care about, how to live in a planet that is doomed to change, and whether they can make heroic technological interventions to try to reverse that inertia before the climate system does it under its own influence. That's the topic of our next guest's book. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer with The New Yorker. She's been doing environmental journalism for many years. Her newest title is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Elizabeth Colbert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get started working on this project?
Well, the thing that got me started on the project, which is sort of exactly in the middle of the book, but was chronologically the first chapter of the book that I reported, was I went to Hawaii to report on a project that had already been nicknamed the Super Coral Project. And it was led by a very dynamic scientist named Ruth Gates, who very sadly passed away about 2 years ago. And the point of the project, or the idea behind the project, was we've changed the oceans really dramatically. That's a function of having poured a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And as you point out, warming the climate very significantly, and the oceans are absorbing a lot of that heat. So the oceans are warming very, very quickly. And, or by oceanic standards, has that. And also a lot of the CO2 that we pour into the air ends up pretty quickly being absorbed by the surface waters of the ocean. And that is changing the chemistry of the oceans, changing the pH of the oceans. So this combined effect is pretty serious. And one of the organisms, or really groups of organisms that we already can tell really doesn't like these changes, is reef-building corals, these tiny little animals that build these amazing structures that are coral reefs. So the idea behind the Super Coral Project was, well, we've changed the oceans. We're not getting back the oceans of the past in any human time frame. And if we want to have reefs going forward, we're going to have to intervene on their behalf again. So we're going to have to counter, sort of one form of intervention with another form of intervention. And the form of intervention that they were looking at, that they are looking at, has been dubbed assisted evolution. And it's basically, can you crossbreed corals that are hardier, are more heat tolerant than the corals that are out there now? And that's really a big question mark.
A generation of ecologists would probably recoil in horror at the idea of breeding and then introducing a new type of coral into the natural world.
Well, this is, in the scale of interventions, and we can talk about other interventions that I talk about in the book. On the scale of interventions, this is actually fairly modest. All you're doing is, in some cases they were, I went to Australia just recently where this project continues. It also continues in Hawaii. They were crossbreeding corals from different parts of the reef. So parts of the reef that are warmer, parts of the reef that are cooler, seeing if any of those offspring were more heat tolerant than their parents. They were also crossing different species to see any of those hybrids were more heat tolerant. Now, these are all things that could conceivably happen out on the reef. They would just be complicated, right? So if I'm two corals and I'm hundreds of miles apart, every year corals have what's called an annual mass spawning event, and billions upon billions of corals release their eggs and sperm into the water, and those find each other, and that's how you get new coral larvae. Now, in theory, right, even corals from different parts of the reefs can meet during this event. They just don't tend to because they're, you know, they're simply too far apart. So these are things that could conceivably happen out on the reef. When we talk about other interventions and when we actually look into the future of, you know, actually manipulating, let's say, corals to survive in warmer oceans, the next step becomes, well, to do even more serious forms of intervention. For example, if you could identify a gene that was associated with heat tolerance, could you actually genetically modify corals to carry that gene? So it leads you down the road from, you know, things that are that could potentially happen out there on the reef to things that could only happen in a lab.
I think the book is really, really great at kind of establishing that continuum of interventions where there don't seem to be any really bright lines. Do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, do you think there is a profound difference between breeding coral and trying to speed up evolution and genetically engineering a super coral?
Well, I think that one of the points of the book, as you suggest, is, you know, you get on a path and you say, that seems okay. And suddenly you find yourself in a place you're like, whoa, did I think that was okay? You know, and that's sort of the path that we're on. I think that's really the point of the book. And if we decide, you know, that's not the path that we want to be on, then we need to pretty radically rethink things.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum. We can discuss some bigger takeaways. What is the white sky that you titled the book after?
So the white sky, yeah. So I spent a bunch of time while I was reporting the book with scientists at Harvard who lead what's called the Harvard Solar Geoengineering Research Program. And what the idea is behind solar geoengineering, it's that we have, once again, get back to the, you know, manipulation number one. We've dumped a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, as your listeners know. That's warming the planet. We don't have any good ways, as you suggested. There's a lot of inertia in the system. Also, carbon dioxide, once you put it up there, it hangs around for a long time, and it continues to warm the planet. So we don't have a lot of options, or at least we don't have a lot of options that people have come up with if we decide we don't like the climate that we have. And that's, you know, unfortunately, well, very, very possible. So at some point you get a climate that you decide is just insupportable for human life or for other species. What do? You can't turn that clock back in a human time scale. And so one of the few methods that scientists have come up with, once again, in theory, is, well, you could counter one form of intervention with yet another form of intervention. So you could counter what we've done by dumping CO2 into the atmosphere, by spraying some kind of chemical compound, sulfur dioxide is one possibility, calcium carbonate is another one. Tiny diamonds have even been proposed, diamond dust. You'd pour that into the stratosphere using some kind of specially designed aircraft. And that would have the effect, that would create this stratospheric haze that would then reflect sunlight back out to space. And that would have a cooling effect. So that would, you know, literally less direct sunlight would be hitting the Earth. And that would have a cooling effect. That's what happens after major volcanic eruptions. And that's solar geoengineering. That's the idea behind solar geoengineering. And one of the many, many potential side effects of solar geoengineering is changing the appearance of the sky so that the sky would appear whiter. And that's the source of the title, Under White Sky.
So this is an idea that is jarring. It is an idea.
To say the least, yes.
That has a lot of potential downsides. One of those compound sulfur dioxide, if you put enough in the right place in the atmosphere, it could basically eat the ozone layer.
Well, that's a very complicated one. I want to say that it interacts with compounds that are already up there eating the ozone layer. It itself does not eat the ozone layer, if that makes sense. So there's some, you know, question as we phase out CFCs and other ozone depleting chemicals, you know, what sort of effects sulfur dioxide would have on the ozone layer.
And there's the question of, you know, what putting a giant sunscreen in the atmosphere would do to, you know, food production and crops, less solar radiation reaching the Earth means less energy to turn into food.
Yes, though I do want to say that I think that there it's quite possible, or once again, I'm not saying this on my own, you know, authority, but on the authority of scientists, that plants actually like indirect sunlight. So it's not clear, you know, how far. I mean, we're talking about fairly trivial differences from the point of view of the actual amount of sunlight that hits the Earth. It's not clear that you would, unless you got into, you know, very, very radical dumping, you know, lots of, you know, you would be dumping lots and lots of reflective particles into the stratosphere to get any effect. But the effects on agriculture are not top of mind concerns, how's that, or not top of the list concerns. Believe it or not, there are other ones that are higher up the list, how's that?
Why don't you walk us through those?
Well, I mean, one big question with solar geoengineering, besides the question of, you know, is this something one should ever think of, which I think is a biggie, is, are you going to change regional weather patterns? Now, I should also say we are changing regional weather patterns right now. I mean, climate change is going to change regional weather patterns, already is changing regional weather patterns. Now, if you add on another layer of intervention on top of that, what kind of change are you going to get on top of that? And many, you know, there's lots of work being done with computer models to try to figure this out. But, you know, a model is not the Earth, and it's unclear, since we're thinking of putting particles in the stratosphere that, you know, simply don't exist there now, there are a lot of unanswered questions about what the impacts would be.
It is so jarring to contemplate the idea of this being pursued as a policy response to climate change. But, you know, in the spirit of the kind of continuum you set up in the book, I was going through mental exercises and thinking, well, if the mechanism is just bounce more light into space, how different would this be from just changing the building code so that every roof and paved surface in the developed world is some kind of white reflective material instead of dark substances that are soaking up light and converting it to heat?
Yeah, there's sort of a, I mean, I think you raise an interesting point and a good point. There's a lot of proposals out there for what is called albedo modification. So albedo is the reflectivity of the Earth. And as we melt a lot of ice, which is very, very, you know, bright and white and reflects a lot of sunlight out to space, and as we replace that with water, which is open water, which is much darker and absorbs a lot of sunlight, we're changing the Earth's albedo. That's one of the effects of climate change, and it's one of the sort of feedback loops of the process. And there are a lot of proposals out there, as you suggest. Well, we're losing ice. What can we do to, you know, make the world reflect more sunlight? How could we humans do that? So there's proposals that we should spread glass beads over the Arctic ice to as they, you know, so that as they melt, they'll still reflect as much sunlight. How's that? It's a very basic formulation of that. There are proposals to brighten clouds so that they would be lighter colored and reflect more sunlight out to space. There are proposals, as you say, to just paint every roof white. You know, so there are all sorts of proposals out there that might not strike you as radical as, you know, actually changing the composition of the stratosphere and preventing a certain amount of sunlight from hitting the Earth. And the question of, you know, there are scientists on who would say that actually those sort of more regional efforts might be even more dangerous because they would affect regional weather patterns in a way that we really don't have a good handle on. And you can't just change the weather locally because, you know, the whole system is connected. So everything you do has ripple effects across the entire system. These are really hard questions to answer, but I think an important thing to keep in mind as we move forward into this sort of brave or not so brave new world is the things that strike you as more innocuous than others, it's not necessarily true. You can't necessarily trust your gut on that.
The whole prospect, the whole conversation around these geoengineering solutions, it has the feel of someone who find themselves on a fast moving vehicle heading towards a cliff, racing against time to figure out an elaborate method for deploying parachutes behind it to slow it.
Yes, but while they're in the racing car, yeah.
But not grappling with the fact that their foot's still on the accelerator. It seems a little premature to talk about atmospheric interventions while we're still making the atmospheric intervention of using coal to make electricity and gas to make transportation.
Yes, and I think a lot of people would say you're right, and we should be spending zero time talking about solar geoengineering before we have brought our emissions down, which we've not done except during COVID for reasons that we all I think basically would agree were not good ones. But there are other scientists, once again, who would say this is precisely the time we need to talk about it because there is so much inertia in the system. So even once you stop, as you suggested at the top of the program, even once you stop emitting carbon to the atmosphere, you've just stopped, you've just stopped digging the hole, but the hole is still there and the inertia of the system is going to carry us forward, as you say, on the order of decades, perhaps longer. And what they would say, I don't have a dog in this show, as they say, but would say, well, this is exactly the time you need to be thinking about it, because at the time that someone reaches for that last minute parachute solution, you kind of want to know whether your parachute is there or not. So that's the counter argument.
Elizabeth Colbert, when you interview the people who devote all of their scientific work to working on these types of interventions, what's driving them? Like, is it faith in the engineering? Is it despair at the political gridlock over intervening in climate change through regulation?
I think that their motives were different, but also also clustered sort of along a matrix of, hope and despair. How's that? That they felt that we need new thinking about some of these problems, that people don't realize how serious some of these issues are and how we're only heading in one direction. And I think they were motivated, some of them were motivated by an opportunity, even a business opportunity. Some of them were motivated by a humanitarian goal. Many of them were motivated by trying to save the natural, what I will call in quotes, the natural world. I thought everyone I spoke to, I want to say, I thought was acting, in good faith. You could argue about whether you agree with what they're doing and whether you think it should actually be deployed in many cases. In some cases, these interventions already have been deployed. In some cases, they're more slightly more futuristic, though probably all within the realm of the doable. You could say, I don't think we should be doing that, but I don't think that all of them were motivated by some impulse to intervene and help. How's that? We didn't have any Dr. No's out there that I spoke to.
Right. How did you react emotionally to covering these things? Were there any experiments or projects that just sincerely inspired hope in you?
Well, I did go to one of the projects that I went to visit, which was much more local in scope, was a project in the Mojave. So a fish called the desert hole pupfish, a beautiful little blue fish that exists only in this one pool in the Mojave Desert. And that fish is in trouble because people started pumping groundwater from the aquifer that feeds this pool. And the level of the pool started to drop, and the fish were down at some point, not that long ago, to something like, I can't remember the exact number, something like 35 fish, okay, in the world. And for these fish, a backup population has been set up in a complete replica of this pool out in the Mojave Desert. They've tried to replicate this pool down to the contours of the pool in a tank, basically, an enormous tank. And I thought that project, visiting that project was visiting Devil's Hole, which is a beautiful, beautiful and very sort of mystical place, was a lot of fun and very inspiring. And visiting the fish in the tank even was inspiring, you know, in its own way. And I think all of the projects that I visited had that aspect to it. They were both, wow, this is cool, this is amazing, but also they have that undercurrent of, wow, this is what we've come to, that was, you know, eerie and disturbing in some way.
It's also kind of like an extended metaphor. I mean, when we talk about, you know, humans as a species having irrevocably changed the climate system and having to contemplate making more inventions in the future to keep the planet habitable, you're talking about us like that pupfish living in an engineered replica of our natural environment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the question, and it's the question before us, and it's a question, you know, to which there's no answer. It's not like there's a right answer, you know, it's sort of like only wrong answers here, of whether more control, attempting to intervene, more synthetic, you know, solutions or measures, whether those are going to save us or bring us or save various species or bring them that much closer to the edge. I think that is a huge question of our time. And that is, you know, the essential question at the heart of the book.
Let me flip the question around. Of all the interventions and possible interventions that you covered, what was the most terrifying?
Well, I think the easy answer would probably be solar geoengineering is pretty high up there. But it's also possible that, you know, with CRISPR, which is this new suite of gene editing techniques. One of the things I do in the book is buy this kit that allows me to gene edit some bacteria in my kitchen using CRISPR. When you think about the possibilities for individuals, literally individuals, you know, creating synthetic life forms basically in their kitchen, that's a slight exaggeration, but not that wild an exaggeration. That might be even more terrifying.
Because of all of the measureless ways it could go wrong.
The measureless ways it can go wrong, and also the way it is very, very decentralized, if that makes sense. It's very difficult to control. Anyone who wants to put a genetically modified organism out onto the landscape in a, you know, legitimate way, in a government-regulated way, and I think this is true all across the world, faces a lot of permitting issues. But anyone who did it, you know, illicitly does not face such permitting issues. How's that? And CRISPR makes gene editing, you know, once again, I don't want to say I personally don't have the capacity to, you know, create a synthetic form of life in my kitchen. But if you were a talented, you know, biohacker, you might be able to.
Yeah. How do you feel about the beat you picked for yourself?
Well, it's never dull. How's that?
Elizabeth Colbert, I enjoy your writing so much. The new book is a real treat. Thank you for speaking to us about it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Colbert's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her brand new book is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. And she'll be discussing it at a KPFA Zoom author event this Thursday with climate journalist Mark Hertzgard. There's details on how to sign up for tickets so you can participate and ask questions at our website, kpfa.org.